So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review
me. Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
But there were two little kids there. One kid was a little red-headed punk. And then there was a second kid named Kane.
I let it fall, my heart. And as it fell, you rose to claim it. It was dark, and I was over.
Legs.
Stand in your arms without falling to your feet.
Oh my God! Skip! My God! Can you believe it?
But there's a side to you that I never knew, never knew.
Hate the love! I swear! It's the truth! It's the truth!
Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock with Wei Ting. How are you doing, Wei?
Pretty good, man.
What a Monday we had. That was a late one.
Why?
Monday, I just felt
raw, yeah.
Lots to discuss. Are you in Royal Rumble mode? Have these old shows
Definitely.
And that go home show on Monday really got you into the mood?
I mean, I'm not so sure about Monday, but certainly watching these past two Royal Rumbles, and you know, for these reviews, has got me in the Royal Rumble mindset. My days are just filled with
anticipation,
clocks counting down.
Imagine every time someone entered a room, there was a countdown clock, and that buzzer went off every time when you don't know who's going to walk into your room or something like that.
That would be very annoying. I would lock my doors, probably.
And there would have to be, like, a big cheer when someone of importance walks into your room, like your boss walks in, Wei.
Yeah, I suppose. Though most of the time, I imagine it would just be silence for most people.
Yes, there would probably be a handful, and probably, like, how many nation members can possibly get put into this Royal Rumble?
Yeah. I'm kind of like getting a feeling of deja vu right now, thinking about as your phone just went off.
You know what I'm doing right now?
What's that?
Turning the volume off so I don't get an email during this
particular
show.
Well, but I remember us like doing a previous Rumble review and thinking about like putting the Rumble sound effect as a phone alert. Or did you mention somebody having that? I don't know. I just like it's a thought that just crept into my brain.
Maybe.
Does that jog your memory?
Maybe.
Okay. Somebody could.
I'm sure someone can let us know what we've talked about in the past. My recall of what we have discussed on shows, not on shows, I could not tell you.
I don't even know why I brought that up. It's like it's not even an interesting point.
That's what this show is for. It's to exercise the mind.
Yeah, I'm just opening my mouth and things come out.
Well, that's what people are here for.
Yeah.
That's the whole design of this.
Yeah.
This entire medium.
Mm-hmm.
What else are you saying, dog?
Not much, man.
Did you hear that X-Pac is awaiting confirmation to see if he can go visit Brandon Dassey in jail?
I've read something about wrestlers his brother asking wrestlers to go and visit Brendan.
Yes.
His brother Brendan. And X-Pac actually signed up.
X-Pac tweeted that he's awaiting confirmation.
Jeez, wow.
To go visit.
Did you see the video from Steve Avery's ex?
The ex-fiance, yeah. Yes.
Can we talk about this, by the
yeah,
way?
Yeah, yeah, now everyone's seen it.
Yeah.
So whatever. It's fine.
Spoiler alert. I'm not going through
what we had to do last. I did a seamless edit last week to put all of our discussion on this show to the end. And it was a very clean block. Uh-huh. Like, sometimes we'll talk about something, trail off, come back, and it can be spoilerish at times, but I thought we were pretty good. This week, I don't care.
Yeah. What did you think of the X's 30-minute interview?
Okay. If I was talking to any member of this family, I wouldn't believe anything they say. That goes from the top on down.
I would extend that to anybody in this town.
Like, I think there isn't a shred of credibility amongst this family that I can believe them one way or another.
Right.
I mean, this woman is portrayed very... It is bizarre in the documentary how she is just... I mean, it's very endearing when these two are on the phone together.
Yeah.
On both ends. I mean, she had her jail stint and he had his jail stint. Very rarely did they actually physically be in contact with one another.
Mm-hmm.
But then she just disappears. And it's led to believe, like, the police said, get out of here. And she left. And it's never really addressed how this woman, who was engaged to this man... Just drops them like a bad habit.
Yeah, the implication in the film is certainly that the police basically kind of threatened her to by continually arresting her and taking her away from her child or something, so that she would stop being in contact with Steve Avery. But in this interview, for those who haven't seen it, she basically for 30 minutes talks about how she thinks Steve Avery did it. And how in their history, she was constantly beaten by him and threatened by him. And, you know, just bringing up a lot, like a side of this guy that really was not really touched upon in the documentary at all. So,
I'm just bringing this up here. Have you heard about Dolores Avery's recent radio interview? The mother.
The mother. No, I haven't heard that.
All right. She was on the WAAF radio station in Boston last week and started discussing the Teresa Halbach murder. And she states, quote, "I don't know, but I wish the person could come forward. I don't think she's even dead. I don't think so."
Oh, my God.
So they went on, and the DJ, I'm just going to read this from this site. When the host pointed out to her that forensic testing showed that Halbach's remains were found in a fire pit just behind Stephen's trailer, Dolores came back and said, "Then somebody planted them. They planted the key," she added, referring to Halbach's car keys that were found inside of Stephen's home. And does she say anything more here? Yes, that's about all. So Dolores isn't even convinced that Teresa Halbach is even dead.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't that put a whole... In her mind, I mean, this is pretty concrete evidence that Teresa Halbach was murdered. But then that would mean there a separate person has died. Who's died, Dolores? Someone was killed here. These were bones.
I don't know. But I...
This family needs to shut up.
Well, why are these people doing interviews anyway? And I'll tell you why. It's because news outlets...
They're celebrities now.
Well, it's...
This is even worse.
It's because news outlets are desperate for any type of attention, you know, that they can get as a result of this very popular TV show and story. And so, I mean, they're bugging these poor people for any type of scoop, even though they, you know, like... What else is she going to say?
You were dead on, though, when you described that people are reacting to this like it's the latest season of your favorite mystery drama.
Yeah, it is.
Like people, being covered is like a television show.
Yeah, that's why. That's how we're talking about it. We're talking about it like the spoilers.
It's true.
Yeah.
Well, that's the latest on making a murderer.
Yeah.
Did you come up with any more conclusions?
No. I kind of stopped thinking about it for a week.
It's yeah, I think once we got it out on the show, I really that was it for me.
Yeah, it's done. It's out of my system. My roommate actually, I told him this to start watching it, and he watched the first episode, and then he ended up reading about the story on Wikipedia, and then after that, he's just like, "Oh, okay, I don't want to watch anymore."
He was turned off by it.
Yeah.
You know what was a turn off over the past week? Apparently, was. My goodness, Wade, did we underestimate the CFL audience out there?
Tell me about it.
You know, this is more on me. I'm going to acknowledge here that I made a critical error in my discussion last week by first stating off the top as if to say the CFL as a whole, no one cares about. When, believe me, and I said this last week, outside of Toronto, the CFL has some extremely strong markets in Canada. Yep. It is big. In places like Saskatchewan and Winnipeg. I never denied that, and we stated as much.
Places where there's nothing to do, as I stated.
That's certainly something to it, of course. I mean, in Saskatchewan, throw them an NBA team, a Major League Baseball team, and let's see where the Rough Riders rank. However, Giant, I think what we were stating last week, and I will not get off of this one, is the lack of interest there is in the Toronto Argos. The Toronto Argonauts are, to me, a failed franchise here. This is a team that loses money in the biggest city in Canada, and you cannot convince me that the Toronto Argonauts are on the radar of people in this city.
They actually lose money?
They do lose money. This is a franchise that is valued at roughly $20 million.
Oh, I could buy that.
$20 million.
No, just kidding. Well, I mean, don't you think, though, their existence is to perhaps just add credibility to the actual league? You can't have a Canadian Football League without a Toronto team.
I think you could. I really feel you could. But I think they're afraid to take a team out of your giant metropolitan area, like a Toronto.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they feel Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, you have to have teams there.
Mm-hmm.
I get that thinking. But I don't believe... I mean, Toronto is just... It's always been this major league market, and I don't believe they've ever looked at the Toronto Argonauts as a major league team. I don't think there's been one time in their history that they were viewed as the number one franchise in this city.
Somebody suggested,
maybe not even number two. And those are during the Grey Cup years.
Somebody on the board suggested that perhaps you were jaded because you were around for the Mike Pinball, Doug Flutie era.
Okay, to that point, they won Grey Cups with those two.
And I'm saying...
They won a Grey Cup in 2004. Exactly. They won a Grey Cup in 96, I think it was.
And I'm saying... Nobody gave a shit about that when that happened.
Like, I have lived through the Grey Cup years, and still, there was not this gigantic fever that overtook the city because our CFL team was performing well. We've seen them perform great. We've seen them perform horribly. It's not a big deal in Toronto. And the best piece of feedback I got was from a listener of ours who is a mascot for a CFL franchise.
Oh, which franchise?
He didn't state. But said that I did make some good points.
Okay.
But I think the general feedback was that I was too harsh on the CFL as a whole, which I did not. I meant this to be more a Toronto Argos criticism that I will not back off of. But the CFL, I don't deny this is a healthy league. They've got a very big television contract with TSN.
Uh huh.
But I will never be going to an Argos game. I don't care if they're performing next door, which they pretty much will be.
You don't have to limit yourself that way simply because of this argument.
You know what I've become more a fan of over the last year? Begrudgingly. I've been intrigued by the NFL. And it's strictly because I follow every Sunday night game as I'm waiting for it to end before the loss starts.
Okay.
And following it. And over the course of an entire season, I'm following and seeing how this team is doing, how that team is doing.
Uh-huh.
I don't have enough interest to tune into a game and watch a game. But I'm constantly looking at my phone for updates.
Mm-hmm.
On my phone, you know when you go to the main thing and it's got like your most visited websites?
Sure.
My second most visited site is NFL.com.
Wow. Just to check review.
Sundays, I like just checking the scores and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I do not classify myself as a football fan.
Okay, good for you, man.
I might watch. Maybe I'll watch a Super Bowl. I don't know.
All right, nice.
Big game this week. Patriots and Broncos. Brady versus Manning.
That's great.
Yep.
Cool.
Anything else? Anything new in your life that you're interested in?
Not really.
Anything you've gotten into?
Well, I'm...
What's next on Netflix for you now that you're done Making a Murderer? What's... You know what? I'm having a really hard time getting through Jessica Jones. I've gotten back...
Oh, you haven't...
I never finished it.
You haven't finished it.
Okay. So I've gone back to it. I'm just painfully trying to get through this.
What episode are you on?
I've got four left.
Okay. I started to enjoy it around that time, so...
That's really late to get into a show, isn't it?
Yeah. It takes
this is like episode
longer.
9.
Sure, it takes a little longer to set up, but I didn't think it was bad. I mean, I enjoyed it pretty much all the way through, especially when you start being introduced to the villain in the show, who I think is the best Marvel villain that they've ever had.
Ever?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, they renewed it for a second season.
Yeah.
I'm more excited for Daredevil coming back soon.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's March it comes back.
Oh, wow. That's soon?
It's pretty soon, I think.
Cool. Nice.
But you haven't watched anything else of late.
I'm trying to think what I might have. I watched some movies. I watched The Hateful Eight over the weekend.
How's that?
It's really good. I watched the Roadshow version in 70mm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and Toronto is like one of the few cities, or one of the... There are only apparently 100 cinemas in North America that are able to show it in 70mm. And so, you know, I happen to live in a city that actually has one. So I went to the Varsity and caught it. And it starts, like, the Roadshow version that they have is basically sort of like his, Tarantino's attempt to kind of replicate how big features were once, you know, presented. And it includes things like an overture at the beginning and a 12-minute intermission in the middle. So,
as if the movie isn't long enough.
It's a 3-hour movie. It's a pretty long movie, but I'll tell you, I really enjoyed the intermission. You know, it was sort of like it culminated. It came right after like a very big scene, and so lights went up, and everybody had a chance to like talk about what they just saw. You know, you could stretch and take a piss and do all that. And for some reason, that was very novel to me.
It's not the worst idea for those 3-hour movies, because there's nothing worse than going into a movie where you know you can't buy a drink because you're going to have to piss 2 hours into the movie, and it's either miss a chunk of the movie where you might miss something of importance,
right,
or you're just in pain for the last hour.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you come back from the movie, Tarantino himself kind of gives you like a big recap about, you know, what had just happened. So all that was like... It was just, it made it a fun experience to like, to see this, to have a movie presented to me in this way. And the movie itself I thought was really good. It was like, I think Tarantino, for what you'd expect of Tarantino, a lot of kind of his hallmarks of like putting people in a room together who hate each other, and there's a gun in there, and something is gonna happen. So for a 3-hour movie, I was very happy.
Was anyone torched on fire?
On fire? No, not to my knowledge.
No brothers that decided to invoke gasoline to resolve their issues?
No. Probably some back injuries, but nothing. No fires.
Did anyone play dual characters throughout the movie? And have like two added personas to their regular one?
No.
No? And make different appearances?
No. We did have a brother and sister, but that was it.
Kind of the same.
Yeah.
Exactly the same as the Royal Rumble.
Sure.
Today's review is on the 1998 Royal Rumble, as the WWF kicked off a year that would ultimately change the fortunes of the company. This was the year that they officially got out of their several year-long... I don't know what you could even call it. Their down period. And 1998 was a complete turnover for them with the emergence of Steve Austin, the Vince McMahon heel character, which there was a very subtle hint to on this show. Whether it was on purpose or not, I noted it.
Hmm.
But we started off, this was in San Jose, California, Sunday, January the 18th of 1998. And what a time period this really was. It opened with this video in black and white with the old voiceover they had, including Steve Blackman and the Headbangers being identified as rookies, Ken Shamrock as the Master of the Octagon, and then we got a montage of guys screaming with extreme close-ups on their face as they were in agony.
This was, you know, these types of openings were, I think, pretty, you know, in hindsight, pretty representative of this era, and in particular their video producer, David Sahadi. In fact, a lot of the earlier TNA openings had a very similar feel to them. And you can probably all attribute it to the work of this guy. You know, epically scripted, usually a lot of slow-mo and close-up shots. And I thought they were all very good. They don't really do these anymore, but at the time, I thought they were very effective.
Some of the best character-building pieces were the start of these pay-per-views, in particular in 1997, where you had these drastic themes that could be encapsulated in these videos to start, where you had these heroes in Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, that the story of like the fall of the hero was very big in 97, where Bret had turned into this villain. Shawn Michaels had gone from this top babyface into this degenerate. Mm-hmm. And the rise of the anti-hero in Steve Austin. And I always thought these videos, they were very much able to hit on those themes.
Definitely.
Very hard.
It gave like a really serious kind of tone to professional wrestling, which
it was
often,
these characters in conflict with themselves almost that they presented.
Yeah.
It was very deep by WWF standards.
Definitely, and pro wrestling is something that I think on superficially, you know, can be a little ridiculous and comical, but these videos I think helped set a very serious artistic tone to them.
And in a case of something that really was not hyperbole, they said the winner of the Royal Rumble has the chance to be the heir apparent to the throne, which would be very accurate in 1998. The 1-800-COLLECT-BLIMP is inside of the San Jose Arena flying around. And we went to a sign near the front row that read, Tyson killed Tupac. This was a show way where there were many, many signs that I took note of.
I think they were friends. Tupac actually died.
It was the night of a Tyson fight in September of 96.
So that's a little offensive.
Yeah, this could have been a Netflix documentary series.
Well, actually, they all have documentaries up there. Biggie and Tupac is up there.
Yes.
Tyson documentaries up there.
Because yeah. Biggie died 2 months after this, right? Like March 98?
97, I think.
Was it 97 or 98?
Pretty sure it was 97.
Okay. The announcers are Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, with one fan behind him with the sign that we saw all night when they were on camera that said, Vince, your tag teams suck. And we had the Spanish commentary team with Tito Santana. We also had the French commentary team, no expense spared on international language, with Raymond Rougeau, one of the few people, Way, that appeared at the 93 Rumble on camera. And who appeared at the 98 one when Ray interviewed Owen Hart on the 93 show.
Good for him.
Mike Tyson is then shown in the private box and was pretty soundly booed by this audience.
Yeah.
Which says a lot.
Where was Tyson at this point in his boxing career?
This was when he was serving his suspension by the Nevada State Athletic Commission after the bite fight with Evander Holyfield. So he had left boxing temporarily, and this was the deal that they had been trying to work together, where the WWF made him a gigantic offer, which later turned out to be about $3.5 million to come in, which was insane money at the time for the WWF to be spending, considering, I mean, they had had tons of financial problems in 97, but they had certainly turned the corner at this point with their pay-per-view price being increasing and not in as rough a shape as they were earlier in 97, but still $3.5 million for this guy who wasn't going to be wrestling a match.
But somehow, I suppose Vince thought he had enough mainstream cachet to think that it was worthwhile.
He was definitely a huge figure at this point and coming off such a big controversy. And at a time when the WWF was, it was almost the opposite of today. They were very much trying to turn their image into this sleazier view from the outside public and embracing that. And Mike Tyson just played to that for them.
And Mike Tyson, I guess, you know, was not really nobody tried to prevent him. Like, no boxing commission, like, had any issue with him.
Nevada gave the WWE – they contacted Nevada. And this is when Mark Ratner was with the Nevada Athletic Commission. And they said he's free to go about doing this.
And they didn't stand in the way.
But he couldn't have a match, would he have been allowed to even have a match?
I'm trying to remember the circumstances at the time. I don't feel he could do a match, or at least that wasn't even really an option at the time. They may have stepped in at that point if he had actually done a match, but he was the Nevada was okay with this. So I guess perhaps Yoel Romero, if he does get suspended.
Oh, boy, what a difference
maker. He could be the guest referee for Hunter and Roman Reigns.
I don't know if they can afford $3 million. Yeah. $3 million wouldn't be enough.
Yeah,
for him.
Yeah, you'd have to go big for Yoel, the soldier of God. The show started off with the artist formerly known as Goldust. There were a series of artists formerly known as in wrestling, with Prince Iaukea being another. And he was accompanied by Luna to take on Vader. We should definitely update where the Goldust character was in early 1998. For many years, I thought there was never a worse representation of Dustin Runnels than this weird run he had. Then he went to TNA as Black Reign, and that to me will always have a special place atop the awful time periods in Dustin Runnels' career.
Okay, let's not forget his run in WCW as Seven, all those other things.
Well, he's had his hits and misses along the years. Mm-hmm. This was after Goldust had turned on his wife, Terry Runnels, and dumped her during an interview segment with Jim Ross. This was supposed to culminate in this feud with Brian Pillman and Goldust after Terry had spent 30 days with Brian Pillman, after this guy had put his wife up for grabs in a wrestling match and lost. And then Brian Pillman, of course, died that October. And so once some time had passed, they shot this angle to break up Goldust and Marlena. And Goldust was now attached with Luna and going through an identity crisis of sorts.
What brought about the costume changes and the identity crisis? Did it have some? Jim Ross seemed to hint that it had something to do with him trying to get the attention of his father or something.
They very much played off of, trying to get out of the shadow of his father and not knowing who he was. Mm. And it was very strange because Dusty was a pretty prominent figure on WCW television at this time. He had nothing to do with the WWF. Mm. Yet it was very much turned into this storyline involving Dusty on WWF without his presence.
Well, kind of like what Stardust is doing.
A little bit, yeah, I guess. Goldust came out in this one-piece spandex outfit with a G-string over top of it with a green wig and blue hair.
Yeah, this was his first outfit of the evening. This was it seemed like it was a time when he had a different outfit for every appearance that he came out in, and tonight he was wearing purple and green stripes with blue hair, purple gloves.
He had a green wig and then blue hair underneath. Yeah. He looked like garbage.
Yeah, I'm sure that was the intent.
I think that was the intent. They also, for the benefit of us who could not remember this on Raw television, showed us highlights of him showing up on television first dressed as the New Year's baby and then as Sable.
Mm. Uh-huh.
Wonderful visuals. And attacking Vader with a coconut. Mm-hmm. Because I guess that week Vince Russo was thinking about Jimmy Snuka and Roddy Piper. Vince Russo and Dustin Runnels had a very close relationship. They worked very close together on the original Goldust character, and I think throughout his career, and this would extend to the Black Reign fiasco, Dustin Runnels always had a trust in Vince Russo with his character direction. And there were cases where I think Vince Russo just went down the Vince Russo path, and this artist formerly known as Goldust era, I think, is a testament to a dead end.
Well, you certainly have to credit him, for developing, I think, what many consider one of the more interesting characters in pro wrestling at all. But I guess in experimentation, sometimes you hit, sometimes you miss.
Now, Vader came out to his WWF theme song in San Jose, California.
Oh, right.
How could anyone think of anyone but Dave Meltzer on The Law?
Every time I watch one of these shows and that it's time comes on, I only think of Dave Meltzer.
We've officially replaced the Vader theme.
Yeah.
So Vader is out,
And we have a singles match. Goldust goes after Vader as soon as he enters the ring and knocks Goldust into Luna on the floor. There was actually a big Vader chant here, and the crowd was relatively hot during the opening of this match. Luna's distracting Vader, and Vader then misses with this sit-down splash. Ross explains that Goldust is attention-starved and wants to be out of Dusty's shadow. Vader is then sent into the steps on the floor, and much like the recent night of barricade spots on Raw, tonight was the night of steel steps and Irish whips into them. There was a sign in the background in the crowd that read, quote, Ted Turner is gay. And that was right in front of the hard camera. Welcome to 1998. Vader then blocks a vertical suplex and splashes him for a two count. Then the Vader bomb gets stopped with a low blow as Luna's distracting the referee. And there's this awful clothesline by Vader that Ross just said that there was nothing pretty about that move. And Luna then jumps onto the back of Vader. Vader, with Luna on top of him, climbs up and hits the Vader bomb, and in the process, might have rearranged Luna's face, which just crashed into the mat violently, and Vader pinned Goldust in 7 minutes and 52 seconds. They replayed this finish of Luna. I can't believe she didn't get knocked out from this. This looked, there was no way to accurately control her landing, and she just looked like she got face planted in the mat.
She looked like she was the cape on Vader's back as Vader went for this Vader bomb. The match, definitely, as Jim Ross said, was not pretty, but I thought that finish made it worth it, you know, just to see that visual of this woman flying across a man's back. It was really cool.
Michael Cole is in the back as Steve Austin arrives in his truck and tells Cole to park it and then goes inside. And then the Godwins show up looking for Austin. And this would be played out all night long. Austin has no friends in the Rumble. He's upset everybody. And the 29 men, they're all going after Austin, who has the big target on his back.
To see how they portrayed Michael Cole in these early shows as, you know, pretty much a skinny nerd who everybody bullies, it's no wonder why he probably enjoyed playing heel so much a few years back.
He was going through his own artist formerly known as Goldust phase, where he was attention-starved later in his career.
Like, you see a character like this, and you just think that this is how serial killers are born.
Wow. Well, that's going a step too far. Then we had... This was weird. This was like we took a match and just awkwardly inserted it into a WWF show. It was when the WWF and AAA still had this relationship going, and we had a 6-person minis match with Sonny as the special referee.
Mm-hmm.
So we had all of these minis who had been given new names in the WWF. Max Mini, who this division was kind of based around, the former Masquerita Sagrada Jr., teaming with Nova, the mini, not the former ECW guy, and Mosaic against Battalion, Tarantula, and the original El Torito, not the current El Torito. So we will go by their WWF names for the sake of sanity here. This was the weirdest match way, because I thought if you just watched it as a match, there was a lot of good stuff in this.
It was awesome.
This crowd could not give a millimeter of a shit about this match.
Yeah. Well, it was a very good match, but didn't belong on this show, in this product. There's no context for it whatsoever.
They just randomly would pop up on television. They really had no character build to them. It was just something to throw in there.
Well, you're talking about a show that was largely, like WWE Raw at this time, largely based around characters and kind of shock. And, you know, seeing little people wrestle very good, but... overall, just kind of athletically based matches didn't seem like it was something that they tried to set the appetite for in this audience.
This was very similar to, they did this a year ago at the 97 Rumble, where it was in San Antonio, and again they had AAA talent on the show, and it was the same result where you had these guys killing themselves, and you had like Perro Aguayo Jr., Hector Garza in there. They were doing all this great stuff, and the crowd just didn't know how to react to them. They just didn't know them all that well. Aside from the fans there in San Antonio that did come with an awareness of the AAA product. But this was just in San Jose, no less. It didn't connect.
Well, in this setting, I mean, you're dealing with an audience that I think for their entire lives has seen little people as comedy. You know, that's how they've been portrayed. And here, these guys wrestled pretty much a straight up match.
Yeah, and it was all played for comedy. This was the, like, Jerry Lawler, this was his WrestleMania main event.
He was treating it like comedy, but the wrestlers themselves weren't.
No, they weren't, but, I mean, this was Jerry Lawler with every short joke imaginable.
Yeah.
They even showed Mike Tyson, who was, like, the only person in the crowd that was loving this.
Yeah.
He was very excited by these little guys. Mosaic hit a tilt-a-whirl head scissors to Battalion, and Lawler notes that Max Mini could play hockey on an ice cube. He's so small. They worked in some spots with Sunny. Max Mini crawling under her. She lifts him up, and then he kicks away at the opponents. Ross getting in a dig at Chris Candido, stating that he's always heard that Sunny likes short guys. And then Torito hits a pescado to the floor. There's a corkscrew dive by Max Mini, a suicide dive by Tarantula, zero reaction, and then Nova with an acai moonsault, and it ends with Max with a head scissor takeover from the top and a crucifix to pin Torito in 7 minutes, 49 seconds.
I never thought I'd see a split screen of Mike Tyson watching some luchador minis going crazy. Not a big reaction from this crowd until the dive started to occur outside. You heard a few applauds, but I just assumed that this was not really an audience that knew how to take this. It really wasn't, didn't really fit at all in this show. But watching it in hindsight, it came about like an unexpected surprise to somebody like us.
The Nation is backstage searching for Steve Austin. Farouk sends the newest member of The Nation, Mark Henry, into the locker room to attack him. But the room is empty, and all they find is a foam middle finger laying on a chair to say, "Fuck you. I'm Steve Austin, and you can't find me." They show Vince and Shane with Mike Tyson in the private box, and throughout the night, Jim Ross was promoting a big announcement from Mike Tyson tomorrow night and trying to be subtle about it, but saying, "Mike Tyson will be in the ring tomorrow night."
Mm.
Clearly driving you to think, oh my God, is he going to wrestle on Raw?
Sure.
No, he would be physically in a ring.
Yeah, and, that's smart.
And it turned out to be one of the bigger angles the WWF has done in the last 2 decades. Then there's a video for the Intercontinental title match with Ken Shamrock going through all the different members of The Nation and going after Rocky Maivia after Mark Henry turned on Shamrock and joined The Nation prior to the show. Michael Cole is with The Rock backstage. They show this clip of Kevin Kelly interviewing The Nation on Free For All, and they get into a big disagreement over who's going to win the Royal Rumble. Rock calls Cole an idiot for suggesting that there is dissension in the group, and then goes on to work in his commentary on Bill Clinton and Paula Jones, and that if you sleep with a dog, you're bound to wake up with some fleas, and that Ken Shamrock will be carried out of this building. As The Rock was getting more comfortable with his promos, and I think still had a ways to go at this point.
He certainly, you know, was not as refined as I think he was in later years, but he definitely had a character and most of the delivery down. It wasn't as exaggerated yet at this time. No eyebrows, no pauses, but he certainly had the confidence. And it's amazing to see how small he was here compared to how he is today.
He was just a mere pebble at this point. The Rock comes out, cuts another promo on the crowd, and that leads to Ken Shamrock coming out for our IC title match, and there were big chants of Rocky sucks, and Jim Ross lists off all of these statistics for the match where Jerry Lawler says he can't remember any of this stuff, but he knows that he could recite Sonny and Sable's bra size. So that's what Jerry Lawler bringing to the table here in 98. Very basic stuff at the start. Kick to Rock's chest, and he gets dropped over the top to the floor. There was this angry Steve Austin fan that was almost dressed like Austin, who was giving the middle finger to The Rock, just outraged. Rock returns, gets the advantage. He rakes the eyes of Shamrock. There's a sign that reads, "Brett's a bitch and screw Ted Turner" at ringside. Rock hit this tornado DDT, and the crowd was actually impressed with this spot. And then Ross said that this is not the seniors tour. Like those other fuckers that present wrestling in this country. Shamrock hit a power slam, hit a Hurricane Rana, then Kama, Mustafa, and D'Lo Brown run down, get onto the apron, and get knocked off, and D'Lo's foot gets caught in the bottom rope, and they were working on him vigorously to untie him. Rock then grabs the brass knucks and hits Ken Shamrock, but Shamrock kicks out. And then Shamrock comes back with a belly-to-belly suplex and pins The Rock at 9:52. Everyone goes nuts, thinking that Shamrock has won the title. But then The Rock complains to referee Mike Chioda about the brass knucks. Mike Chioda confronts Shamrock and finds the brass knucks inside of the trunks of Ken Shamrock, and the decision gets reversed, and Ken is disqualified. And the replay would show that after Rock clocked Shamrock with the knucks, he put them into Shamrock's trunks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought... Sorry, was that it? Are you done with the...
Oh, I was done with this match.
Okay. I thought it was a very good match. I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, you know, yes, there's a dusty finish, and there's really no precedent for checking somebody's tights after a match. But nonetheless, I thought the idea was pretty clever and did its job of prolonging this feud. I thought these two were very impressive. I think they're both pretty underrated as professional wrestlers in ring. And perhaps that's because both of them are famous for excelling at other aspects. You know, The Rock with his mic work, and of course, shoot fighting with Ken Shamrock. But I thought the match was very good. Had a realistic feel. I thought these two were both very hot as characters. And in particular, Ken Shamrock, who I forget that he was so over. I certainly think one of the more over baby faces here. And in terms of how much the crowd reacted to him, he was on par with, if not above, The Rock, I felt, on this show.
What do you feel is more stunning in 2016, Wei, 18 years after this event, that The Rock could have a pro wrestling match this year, or that Ken Shamrock will have an MMA fight this year?
Yeah, I don't know if I would have...
Do you think both will happen in the next few months?
Oh, yeah. Oh, The Rock, maybe not so much, but Ken Shamrock, well, we know.
Well, he's scheduled to fight Hoist.
Yeah.
Will it happen, I guess, is the question.
I think it'll happen, yeah.
Ken doesn't get hurt.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Ken very over at this point. I wasn't as enamored with the match as you were, but there was a big angle afterwards where Shamrock attacked Mike Chioda with a belly-to-belly and then applied the ankle lock and... certainly keeping a lot of heat on Ken Shamrock. And one of those rare instances at this time period, at least, where the guy going for the title at the Rumble would also come back and get another match at WrestleMania, as they would go to this match again. Los Boricuas, remember them, Wei? They were looking for Steve Austin backstage, and they attack a guy that they thought was Steve Austin, and guess what? It turned out it wasn't.
Who was it?
It was just a random guy who was never identified. A guy that clearly was Steve Austin from behind to them. And then DOA is inside of the same room, and we get into a big brawl amongst DOA and Los Boricuas.
Hmm.
The gang warfare that was going on at the time.
Can you name all the members of both of these factions? Let's test your knowledge.
Well, on DOA's side, Crush was still, I think, a part of DOA at this point.
He wasn't on this show, but...
maybe he had left by this point.
Yeah.
There was Chains,
uh-huh.
8-Ball,
yeah.
Skull.
Yeah.
Was there a fourth guy? I think that was it. I think it was just those three with Crush. Crush was made the four.
Yeah, you got him. And then
Boricuas.
The tougher one is...
Savio Vega. Boricuas. Miguel Perez.
Yeah.
Jose Estrada.
I can't even bring it up, but... okay. Keep going.
And Jesus.
Wow. Damn. You deserve this job.
Los Boricuas.
Damn, that's very impressive.
Perhaps they'll go into the Hall of Fame this year, the four of them.
Doubt it.
They can officially call it a truce with DOA.
Hmm.
Well, I guess the Harris boys are unavailable. They've got to cut Impact that week.
Mm-hmm.
The New Age Outlaws against the Legion of Doom for the WWF Tag Team titles. This was when the Outlaws had just been paired together a few months earlier, and it was a career revival for these two that I have to say, Wei, had they not been paired together, Rockabilly and the Real Double J probably would have been cut at this point by the end of 97. So
mm-hmm.
What a turnaround for these two, and now we have one guy heavily influenced in booking SmackDown, and the other guy is free to do whatever weightlifting tournaments he so chooses now.
This was before they joined DX officially.
Yes, yes. They had not officially joined yet. They were kind of just subtly linked at times.
I'm watching the show, and I'm reminded here that there was a point where Billy Gunn and Road Dogg were considered young and hip. Like, I just look at them as dads now, you know? Like, uncles that think they're trying to be cool, but not anymore. But there was a point where they're actually somewhat representative of, you know, their generation.
The new hipsters, yeah. Billy Gunn and Road Dogg.
Yeah.
The Outlaws come out, and they're wearing Green Bay Packers jerseys because Green Bay had just beaten the San Francisco 49ers the week prior. And the best part of this way was as they came out for their entrance in these Brett Favre jerseys, they cut to a fan booing them who is also wearing a Packers jersey in the crowd.
Hmm.
What a weird one. Cole is with the Legion of Doom backstage. Animal has a back injury. Animal then yells about doctors not knowing what they are talking about and was so angry he yelled at the wrong camera for his entire promo.
Oh.
And then Hawk tried to one-up him with more yelling. And, man, whether
somebody didn't give him the memo that yelling was...
Animal was ahead of his time in 98. Just between the red and black and the yelling, I couldn't get the ascension out of my head during this promo between these two. Which is funny because it was the New Age Outlaws who kind of just destroyed the Ascension like a year ago when they were called up to television. So the New Age Outlaws are, you know, they bridge generations. The Outlaws then jump them at the beginning. Road Dogg gets caught and is powerbombed by Animal. The Outlaws get sent to the floor and they tease leaving when Hawk and Animal bring them back. Jim Ross lists off the teams that LOD has dispatched over the years, from the Horsemen, the Midnight Express, and the Rock and Roll Express, and the Minnesota Wrecking Crew, which really put a showcase on the run they have had in the WWF. They were great a decade ago. Here in this company, we didn't know what the fuck to do with them. Road Dogg at some point had this bloody mouth. Did you catch what happened here?
No.
Hawk then hits the Rude Awakening reverse neckbreaker. Also on television, what had set this up was this big attack by the Outlaws, which culminated in them shaving off instead one of Hawk's mohawks.
That's just mean.
He looked so stupid having the one there.
Yeah.
He should have just been like, okay, we're going to grow these both out together. Because the one, it's not even a middle mohawk. It's to the side. It looks awful. And this man traveled with this for weeks.
Maybe he thought he was going to start something new.
Well, as LOD 2000, remember, he came back with hair.
Right. No, that was even more.
He was in store for a big 1998.
Yeah.
Where he would climb literally to new heights on the Titantron and then plunge to new lows. The match continued. Hawk applied this very lazy-looking STF to Billy Gunn.
There was a long time where I don't think JR understood what STF stood for, so he would always call it, like on this show, he called it the step over to crossface.
The STCF? The STC?
Yeah. So.
Well, the road
dog. At least he attempted to call it something.
Yes. Road Dogg trips Animal from the floor, and they fight on the floor, and it leads to Animal being tossed into the steps. Hawk then runs shoulder first into the post, and then Road Dogg handcuffs Hawk to the post. Animal is left on his own. He fights back and hits a double clothesline. Ross is calling on Jimmy Corderas to make a judgment call because of Hawk being handcuffed to the post. Billy Gunn comes off the top into an Animal power slam with this very awkward drop. Road Dogg then just ends it with a chair shot, and they are disqualified at 7:55. They continue to attack Animal with the chair as Hawk goes incredible Hawk here and just tears the handcuff off and breaks free and attacks the Outlaws with the chair and clears the ring.
Yeah, I thought it was a really striking visual seeing Hawk here handcuffed, forced to watch his friend get beaten up in the ring. And I liked that part a lot. But then the dude tears through handcuffs, and that just...
You've never done that?
Took me right out of it. I mean, Jim Ross calls it an adrenaline rush. All right, fine.
I agree.
Come on, man. The moment a man is able to tear handcuffs apart is where my suspension of disbelief kind of ends. That was a little too much.
I would hope, Wei, that if I was being attacked with a chair, you would have the inner fortitude to conjure up that amount of strength.
I would need a lot of adrenaline, I think.
So then they go, they were giving away Austin's truck, which just showed up. I mean, this company really had it out for Austin, giving away his mode of transportation to get home afterwards.
Was it his particular truck?
He drove up in it.
It was the same one?
I don't think Austin would be caught dead driving this thing in public. This was worse than Rampage Jackson's truck that like had the custom like Austin mannerisms and logos all over this thing.
I would love to know the whereabouts of this truck today. I mean, how quickly did Mildred Bowers here rip off these decals? Did she even keep the truck?
I would imagine it is living in some auto parts area in millions of pieces nationwide. Mm. Probably in the same, maybe it's in the parking lot of that house they gave away at In Your House.
Mm.
So Mildred Bowers of Nashville, Tennessee won. I don't know why, but I question the legitimacy of that name.
Mildred Bowers?
Why? Mildred Bowers. It just doesn't sound like a real name.
It sounds like a very middle of America made up name.
Do you think she'd be on Facebook?
Doubtful. But why not?
Mildred Bowers, Nashville. 12 records found. There is a Mildred Bowers on Facebook.
Okay.
Is this that's Hampton, Virginia. She couldn't have moved in all this time.
If you, anybody out there knows Mildred Bowers, the same Mildred Bowers who won, we'd love to be in contact to find out the current whereabouts of the Stone Cold truck that she won.
Yeah, well, there is a Mildred Bowers here in Nashville.
Are there phone numbers there?
Do you want to call her? No, they're censored.
Oh, okay. No, let's not bug her.
Okay, she's probably... This is crazy. Like, they have a Google satellite here of where she lives.
Why don't you look up...
She's 82 years old by this record. Maybe it's true. I wonder what her net worth is and how much that truck might have.
Wow, it's got all that.
That's kind of scary that amount of information is available in
Have you ever tried Googling John Pollock?
Nope. There's a lot of John Pollocks out there.
Google John Pollock. I'm curious. Yes, it's that point of the show. Yeah. First result.
Well, it's probably customized to me, isn't it?
No.
Like you come up here.
Okay, but your picture actually appears on the right side, and it's custom image, like a celebrity.
There's a John Pollock on LinkedIn that I can tell you is not me because I'm not on LinkedIn. Wow. Managing director of Southwestern Ontario Angel Group.
He kind of looks like how you would look when you're middle-aged. He does kind of look like you.
Well, this guy. Look at this.
Okay, I think this podcast has a...
Look, he's got his own title here. Artrepreneur. Artrepreneur. I've never heard of that in my life.
What is it?
Well, it's like an entrepreneur, but you're segmented in art.
Sounds very douchey.
Artrepreneur.
Yeah, I'm not an entrepreneur. Let me correct you.
So then we had a rare instance where the Royal Rumble did not close the show. What did you think of this decision? These were your arguments. You either go off the air with the big baby face win, or you have to follow a death with a match. I can't say they made the wrong choice.
The choice is obvious. I thought the main event was a good match, but I certainly was more entertained watching the main event than I was watching this Rumble. I wasn't that pleased with it.
This Rumble sucked.
Yeah.
We're going to go through it. The Rumble match, we had a preview, all geared around Austin. I mean, the whole goal of this match was, okay, there is one obvious winner, and one obvious winner only. Like, there were no arguments of, maybe they'll go this way.
No, they didn't waste time teasing you with the possibility of anybody else winning this.
So it was, can we at least get people to doubt the finish for a second?
Mm.
That was the goal of this match. Yeah. And literally, it was saying that every single person in this match wants to eliminate Austin. Mm-hmm. So that there is a sliver of doubt that he could win this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they were setting out to accomplish over this next hour.
Mm-hmm.
We started things off with Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie. You know, last week's review for the 93 show, it was a modern-day miracle that 43-year-old Bob Backlund was in this at number two. Well, this year we had 53-year-old Chainsaw Charlie.
Oh, my.
We couldn't just go with Terry Funk. We needed to update the Terry Funk character to incorporate a man with a chainsaw and pantyhose over his head to give him a modern-day feel. So Chainsaw Charlie came out. His music was chainsaw sound effects.
What else would it be?
I guess that's the only direction you could go with the guy. And they decided to start this with a bunch of chairs in the ring. And Charlie just stands there and allows Foley to hit him in the head with a chair. To which Foley then graciously handed a chair, and he took a pair of chair shots straight to the head. Welcome to 1998, Dr. Bennett Omalu.
These just get tougher and tougher to watch as time progresses and we learn more about what goes on in inside of a head after a chair shot. I could only imagine what somebody reacting to this would be if they watched this after concussion.
In third was Tom Brandy, who I guarantee you it would take you longer to sip a glass of brandy than it was for this guy to be in and out of the Rumble, because he was in this for about 10 seconds.
I didn't know this guy was still around. I didn't know who he was.
This was Salvatore Sincere.
Yeah, then I looked it up and I Tom Brandy.
Tom Brandy.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Plays for the Patriots.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Nice one way. he's instantly eliminated. The fourth entrant was The Rock, who came in, and he was going to be given the marathon story in the Rumble. He would go right till the end after coming in fourth. Jim Ross openly notes that Funk and Cactus Jack have probably suffered some concussions already.
Hmm.
So there you go, Jim Ross on top of things. There's a trash can shot to The Rock, and then they place it over his head, and they start punching at it. And the crowd was hot for this. They loved watching The Rock with a garbage can over his head. The depth on this show, Way. Headbanger Mosh came in fifth. Terry Funk hit a fucking moonsault that barely hit Mosh. Vinnius Godwin was next in, to which Ross noted, this is living proof of what happens when cousins marry. Then we had 8-Ball. Then we had Black Jack Bradshaw.
At this point, Foley got eliminated by Chainsaw Charlie.
That's right. Jack runned at Funk, missed, and landed on the floor. He was out. And I've got to say, Way, for one of the bigger names, like you could say Cactus Jack was one of the top four people in this Rumble, maybe top three.
Mm-hmm.
There was no reaction when he was eliminated.
It was not at all a flashy elimination, but that was...
This was not a very hot crowd overall on this show, I thought.
I didn't think the match was that great. I didn't think they sectioned off many sections. They didn't give you a lot to focus on throughout most of the Rumble. But in particular, but this Foley elimination was because he was going to come back.
Yeah, but the crowd didn't know that.
Right.
So then Jerry Lawler starts noting at this point that he's gotten word from the back that someone has gotten to Steve Austin and he may not make it into the Rumble. Bradshaw would come in eighth, and this dude lasted 35 minutes in the Rumble.
Hmm.
Odd choice. Number nine.
I expect a lot of times when that happens, it's just because they kind of fall through the cracks. And
they don't realize how long he's been there. They didn't have big plans for the Black Jack Bradshaw character.
I wouldn't think so.
Owen Hart was in ninth, which, what a story for this guy in terms of coming out of the Survivor Series and the thought that this will be the guy that's going to get the revenge on Sean for what happened to his brother and play that out. And certainly, I can't criticize. The WWF made the right choice in Steve Austin was going to be that guy to represent kind of those that believed that Brett was wrong by Vince. It was Steve Austin that was going to play out the babyface to counter Vince. But Owen Hart, just 2 months after the Survivor Series, and at a time when, look at this depth on this roster at this point, this guy is walking down to the aisle and gets attacked by Jeff Jarrett, the NWA North American champion, and Owen is spinning his wheels in a feud with Jeff fucking Jarrett.
Can you explain to me this NWA invasion that they had in the late 90s?
This started with Jim Cornette doing those infamous rants on Raw about... He would be cutting promos on WCW and even guys in the WWF, and then they had to... Progress it somewhere.
They had to turn it into a match somehow.
It was Jim Cornette going back to what wrestling was, and what better represented that than the NWA, which they were able to have a relationship with because they would take any focus that WWF would give them. And it led to a segment where they brought in, they brought on Jeff Jarrett to be the NWA North American champion.
Oh, makes sense.
The Rock and Roll Express were brought in. It didn't work. It's a spoiler.
Sounded like a terrible idea.
Well, the fact that Owen Hart, who was legitimately... I mean, if there was a time to propel this guy as a singles babyface, it was the fall of 97.
Well, you could see this crowd really wanted it. He got a huge reaction on this show.
When he returned... Because he disappeared after the Survivor Series, obviously. Mm-hmm. When he came back and attacked Shawn Michaels, people went nuts for this guy. And there was certainly a lot that could have been done. He certainly had his enemies that, I mean, he inherited a lot of the heat that his brother took with him to WCW. They had lost the Bulldog and all of that. Neidhart left the company. And here's Owen, who was kind of left in the middle of this. Guys are angling for these top spots. And Owen just stayed in this role. And then they put him in the Nation. I mean... Very much mishandled.
How much do you think of that was resulting from Shawn himself?
Probably a lot. Probably, I mean, it was in a bad spot in that regard. And I'm not saying Owen should have been the top guy. There's no way you can make that argument.
You could have made a lot of money.
You could have done more than what they did with him. Mm-hmm. He should not have been floundering in the Nation and being in the spot he was in 1998, where he was... He was in like a Dolph Ziggler role, essentially. I mean, that's kind of a comparison, I guess. Then we had Steve Blackman in 10th. 11th was D'Lo Brown. Kurgan.
This is a really boring rumble by this point.
Oh, dude, it was... How many Kurgans? I mean, we always look at the WWF, and it's like there's always this... The latest big guy.
Yeah.
Like, how many failures do we have of these guys?
No, yeah,
Vladimir Kozlov.
John Gonzalez last week.
Jackson Andrews. I mean, Ezekiel Jackson.
For sure.
Kurgan.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing.
They always tend to come in with the same pattern. They come in, you know, with a big kind of surprise, and they try to book them seriously. And I would say, like, in a rumble is when a big guy like that, without that much in-ring talent, has the most ability to shine. But beyond that, there's not that much... potential, unless you're actually a very talented big man like an Undertaker. So
13th was Mark Mero, who got a reaction because he was accompanied by Sable. Jim Ross says that Mark Mero needs a charisma bypass. Then Ken Shamrock is out. Shamrock goes after Kurgan, takes him off his feet for a big pop, and then everyone gangs up on Kurgan to eliminate him. Crowd's chanting for Sable as Thrasher enters the mix. Then 16th was Mankind. And he goes after Chainsaw Charlie and knocks out Terry Funk, who was in this thing for 25 minutes and 23 seconds. They booked the oldest guy to go the third longest in this match. Then Goldust came out 17th. Goldust knocked Mankind over, eliminating him.
Goldust had a wardrobe change, too.
Oh, good for him.
He repainted his face a different color and wore a different outfit.
Just like Stardust for his... Tribute to David Bowie. Right.
I wonder where all these outfits are today.
Hopefully in an incinerator. There was no reaction as Mankind was eliminated either. I'm not recapping all the eliminations. I think you can all agree that Steve Blackman was not winning this. I mean, this was a really shitty rumble, I've got to say. Goldust. Then Jeff Jarrett comes out 18th. Ross says that Luthez is probably nauseous watching this in Virginia Beach. I would bank significant money that Luthez was not watching this pay-per-view. Owen then runs in and attacks Jarrett. Owen then skins the cat, eliminates Jarrett. That did get a big reaction. And thus we have that feud to eventually look forward to, which really didn't go all that far. And these two would actually become tag champions a year after this. 19th was the Honky Tonk Man, who was in this match for way longer than he needed to be in 1998.
Was he the surprise?
I wasn't surprised. I mean, he was kind of on the roster here and there, like doing announcing, and he had been doing some managing. I mean, he was present on WWE television in some capacity.
There was a lot happening here. Right after Honky comes out, The Rock actually eliminates Ken Shamrock.
Yes.
And announcers and cameras kind of miss everything that kind of led up to the elimination. And that's where I felt like this Rumble wasn't really paced very well. It wasn't really directed very well. There are a lot of moments like that that just we missed and weren't really built up to.
Yeah, as soon as Honky Tonk Man came out, he was followed by Triple H and Chyna. And Hunter was hurt at this point, so he's on crutches. And Owen gets distracted by Chyna on the floor. Owen just looked like an idiot here because Owen catches the crutch shot from Chyna, and then right next to him, like immediately to his left, as if I was like walking in his way as watching something on his computer, did not see Hunter, who blasts him with a crutch and eliminates Owen. So Owen had two feuds going on here.
He had two of them that took place, and I was a little disappointed because neither of those feuds were really told within the Rumble itself. They were both just guys running in and attacking him outside of the match.
Then poor Owen sprints to the back after these guys and wipes out as he hits the backstage area at the last second where you can clearly see him slip. Yeah. This was not a great night for
Owen.
If
you didn't see it, Jerry Lawler made sure to point it out.
Yes, just to remove all doubt. In 20th was Ahmed Johnson. If ever you wanted to see a babyface that had cooled off, it was Ahmed Johnson.
He cooled off and expanded.
Yes, and drenched in water. This guy just walked out of a sauna or the ocean. And they show a replay where Rock hit Shamrock with a low blow before eliminating him. Mark Henry is out 21st and tosses powder into the eyes of Ahmed. We got two powder spots on this show.
I had no idea where Mark Henry found this powder. And again, it was like something that really was not focused on, because I just assumed that the director didn't know that it was going to occur.
The 22nd spot, no one came out. So the announcers were there to explain that that must have been Steve Austin's spot and he's not in the Rumble. We actually never got it clarified on the broadcast whose spot this was or what this was.
Yeah, who was
so
this?
It was a 29-man Rumble.
There's no payoff for this mystery.
The only thing it was done to do was for the next 4 minutes, you doubted if Austin was in this Rumble. And the toughest part was it was kind of designed so that the pop would be that much bigger when Austin's music hit, which that was a given it was going to be.
Yeah.
But the crowd didn't know this story. They didn't know the story of Lawler saying he's been attacked.
Yeah.
So they were just confused by this, as were most people at home as well, because there was really no explanation here. Henry and D'Lo work together and eliminate Ahmed. Vinius then takes a back body drop to the floor and nails Jack Doan in the head with his foot. And then Ahmed attacks Vinius Godwin on the floor to set up that big WrestleMania program.
Yeah.
Awesome. In 23rd was Kama. This was one of my favorite moments of the Rumble. He comes out as Ahmed's walking to the back, and Kama just shoves Ahmed Johnson. And Ahmed gets set to go after him, and then just stops, shrugs his shoulders, and goes to the back. It's like, nah, fuck it. He got me. And he just walks to the back of defeated man. I just wrote at this point, this is a very dull Rumble. 24th was Steve Austin, who comes out. Everyone in the ring stops, and Austin comes from behind, attacking everyone. Out goes Mero, 8-ball. He chokes D'Lo with his vest, and Mike Tyson is losing his mind in the private box, cheering for Code Stone.
Austin definitely, you know, was a major shot in the arm of this match. The guy just ran in with so much wild energy, and he was just immediately captivating to watch, which... obviously, maybe by design, but this match sorely needed somebody like that.
The 25th entrant was the Confederate shirt-wearing Henry Godwin, which thankfully the WWF didn't market at the time. Number 26 was Savio Vega, and all of Los Pericos run in and go after Austin, even Jesus. And Vega misses with a spinning heel kick and hits his teammate. And Austin just murders Goldust with a clothesline. Farouk is in 27th. This is like the fifth time we've heard the Nation entrance music in this match.
Yeah.
Immediately goes after The Rock. The Nation was so weird in this match. You had the dissension between Rock and Farouk. That made sense. But then you randomly had Rock and D'Lo fighting without any backstory of any problems with them, other than that vignette backstage where they couldn't agree who would win. But they were just, they had many options on targets, and they decided to just fight with each other, and it was no big deal.
I felt like D'Lo in particular, he was trying to, show the idea that even there are no teammates in the Rumble. But I felt like D'Lo was almost doing it a little too much. Like, he would go out of his way to attack his own teammates when there are clearly plenty of others in the ring they should have been working together to attack.
Austin and Rock then fought to the floor, where Austin got sent into the apparatus used to get up to the apron if you need assistance. 28th was Dude Love. So we got three appearances by Mick Foley.
But yeah, like each one of Foley's, I thought it was probably one of the more memorable things from this Rumble, the multiple Foley appearances, and I thought it was clever. But watching it live, it didn't seem like any of these received that big of a reaction.
No, it's one of those like Rumble moments that people always bring up, the year Foley entered three times, and it's like, it's just constantly brought up, and watching it on this show is like, to me, it's just like, man, you had no one on this roster.
Yeah.
That was the meaning of it. Chains came in 29th, which just backs up our point.
He looked like I almost for a second thought it was The Undertaker in his biker gimmick, but he looks like a mini version of that.
I'm surprised Undertaker didn't do double duty and then come back for the title match after. Ross proclaims that The Rock has been in this match for over 50 minutes, which is really incredible because the match was only 49 minutes. So The Rock was doing unbelievable stuff in early 98. And the 30th entrant was Vader, who comes out, tosses out the Honky Tonk Man. Austin then eliminates Thrasher, tosses out Kama, sends out Vega. Goldust then just out of nowhere clotheslines Vader out. And that was it. 50-50 for those two. Godwin then runs at Dude Love, misses, and Henry Godwin is not going to WrestleMania. Chains tosses out Goldust. Austin sends out Chains, which the camera missed. I didn't. And it's down to Steve Austin, The Rock, Farouk, and Dude Love. Austin and Foley work together. Then they fight each other. Austin hits a low blow to break out the mandible claw out of it. And then Farouk clotheslines Dude Love. Rock will not help Farouk and comes up from behind tossing out Farouk. And there was a lot of heat for the final two here. And Austin and The Rock and catches him with the stunner, goes to eliminate Rock. They did a near elimination spot, and that's when he hit the stunner and tossed him out. 55 minutes and 24 seconds, and Rock was in this for 51 and a half minutes. So clearly a big spotlight on the guy that they, as early as this point in early 98, saw a big future in, rightly so. And the right guy won this match. I don't care how predictable it was. There was no plan B beyond Austin for this.
Absolutely.
But not a great Rumble.
Crowd was not any less excited, you know, knowing that this was going to be the finish.
Oh, Austin was super over here.
Definitely. Very impressive performance from Austin, just full of intensity the entire time he was in the ring. And I thought the pairing of him with The Rock as the final two was a great preview of things to come just a year later.
Yeah, I think with the Rumble, so much is looked upon, especially the early years, which I would classify this as, you know, those first 11 shows that are out there. A lot of it is nostalgia. It was such a unique match, and you remember little memories like that. And then, like, 2001 to me was the turning point where you started having the surprise entrances.
Right.
And the roster was so much better in 2001. You compare the roster in 01 to 98, night and day. And the matches became much better worked, much better layout.
Mm-hmm.
They worked to key spots, and Rumbles like this kind of became more thing of the past. Where, I mean, it was of these 55 minutes, I would say 40, three of it were pretty dead minutes.
Yeah, I was very... I actually liked last week's Rumble from, what is it, 93, a lot more than this one. I thought at least in 93, you can argue that with as weak, if not weaker, of a talent roster. But in 93, I thought they booked it with actual chapters where you can follow clear storylines throughout. This, I just didn't think that they were very creative with it, and there are just a lot of dead moments in there where not much was happening, nobody to really focus on.
I have a trivia question for you.
Okay.
There were two people that entered both the 1998 and the 1993 Royal Rumble. Can you guess which?
Two people?
Two people were in both Rumbles.
Okay, let me think. Owen?
Owen's one.
I'm trying to think who else. Who else would have been on the roster?
It's kind of hard.
It's not Goldust. No. Kind of hard. Okay. Give me 1 second. Let me actually run through this.
No. You don't get to use your phone.
Why not? I'm running through the list of all the people in this Rumble.
Well, of course that's going to probably remind you by looking at the list.
Oh, I can't do that?
Well, this is a trivia question, Way.
The second person to enter both times.
Do you want a hint?
Sure.
He appeared as different gimmicks.
Yeah, I would assume.
Okay, well.
It's not
drastically different.
Okay.
It's not like Owen Hart in both, who's playing different characters, but you know what I mean. This is a much more distinct.
Was it Chains?
No. No.
No, you just tell me. I don't want to waste people's time.
Kama and Papa Shango.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Not exactly one that comes to mind easily.
Yeah.
You know what one of the best parts of this was? And I don't even know if this was done on purpose or not, but in hindsight, it was brilliant. They went to a reaction shot for Mike Tyson of Steve Austin winning the Rumble.
Yep.
And Mike Tyson is going nuts celebrating with Shane McMahon. Mm-hmm. And there was no Vince McMahon there.
He was there later, though. Or was
he was
there
showing
earlier?
There. And they purposed – I don't know if this – but think of that. If they had Vince celebrating this,
Shane was celebrating too?
Shane and Tyson were showing celebrating Austin win, but right. Vince was not. Which, to me, if that was an attention to detail, I give him a total thumbs up on that little attention to detail, because why would you have Vince celebrating this?
Yeah, or maybe he was just decided to go to the back.
Whatever it was.
It worked out.
In hindsight, it was a great omission to not have Vince part of that celebration in the press box, even though Vince was a babyface at this point,
right.
Technically. Michael Cole interviewed Tyson afterwards, and he said, "Cold Stone is my man."
Oh, my God, this interview.
And calls, when he talks about the next match, this was the best minute interview ever, calls Shawn Michaels a young, up-and-coming tiger.
As the man nears his retirement 2 months later.
This was awesome.
It was a great Mike Tyson
Cold
interview.
Stone.
He also mentioned here that he had bet on Steve Austin to win, and he's going to celebrate tonight.
He so bet on him.
Put some money into Cold Stone.
I don't know about the morals of that one. So then they show a video for the main event with the highlights of their Hell in a Cell match.
How do people, like, the amount of times that we've heard people mess up Stone Cold by saying Cold Stone is staggering to me. How do people mess that up? Is Cold Stone a thing? Like, it's aside from the ice cream.
The ice cream place, of course.
I know, but prior to the ice cream place existing, like... Why? What would lead anybody to make that mistake? Cold Stone.
Well, I mean, you don't...
I'm going to name you... Like, who the fuck would want to be named Cold Stone?
Cold Stone.
What the fuck does that mean?
The Cold Stone Creamery. I mean, that's what they would name it after. I mean, imagine...
That's because you put ice cream on a cold stone.
Could you imagine if, like, years later they had come up with the Stone Cold character and Austin's like, nah, people are confused with the ice cream one. Oh, I got to come up with something else.
For sure they wouldn't use it today.
He would have been Chili McFreeze.
Yeah.
So
Marvel slab.
We got the angle on television going into this was Kane coming to the aid of the Undertaker, who was being attacked by DX, and they teased the brothers finally being aligned together going into the Royal Rumble, which was a nice swerve that was not done just to confuse people. It was done with a purpose to get you the ultimate reaction of how this would end.
One of many.
Yes, yes.
In their relationship.
Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. Casket match for the WWF title. Triple H and China were out there with Michaels. And Ross put over Michaels, winning all the titles in the WWF. Something that Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage cannot say.
Oh
man, Ross just was like shining up that middle finger throughout this broadcast. And they cut to Mike Tyson crotch chopping away in the private box.
This
guy was a child.
And he still is.
In a good way.
Yeah, like when you're, he's, I think he, you know, he's always kind of in the mainstream, had a presence about it, but I would say, like, especially in recent years, he's like, his like, whimsical attitude has just, like, been very fun to watch, and you know, even in a show like this, watching him watch wrestling is a fun thing.
It's almost like he's this celebrated character now, and
he's a big kid.
It's just conveniently, it's, what did he go to jail for? He insists he didn't do it, and we just overlook that, and it's just, it's kind of weird.
Yeah, but, yeah. I mean, well, what about Floyd? You know, what about any of these, anybody?
I don't think Floyd is a celebrated character the way Mike Tyson is.
Michael Jackson, you know?
I just feel with Mike Tyson, I think it's, people are willing to give him the benefit of the doubt that maybe he didn't do what he went to jail for.
I don't know about that.
I don't know.
I think people just don't think about it.
So he is out here, followed by The Undertaker. And I didn't realize how early in the match the spot happens. I mean, this is the match where Michaels did the majority of the damage to his back as he took the back body drop 90 seconds into this match, where the edge of his back clips the casket on the way to the floor. And this guy went on to wrestle another 20 minutes after this.
Yeah, I had no idea this spot came in so early, too. Did he have a history of back problems before this, or was this the main incident?
I think he had had, like, issues. I mean, certainly he had had the knee problems. Yeah. And
it's all that's connected, too.
Like,
right?
I mean, there's very few wrestlers, I would imagine, that don't have back issues, the degree of which varies. But he would have an MRI just after this, where he was in ungodly pain.
Two herniated discs.
And a crushed disc.
Ouch.
So this would be his last match before WrestleMania. But I was just amazed that it was this early in the match, 90 seconds in. It's been years since I've watched this.
To watch the rest of this match, knowing in hindsight what his back must have been like, it made the experience completely different.
Oh, he comes off the top, gets hit with a power slam in midair. Then Michaels is sent into the casket and throws powder at The Undertaker, which just came out of nowhere. I guess maybe Mark Henry left it in a casket.
With Mark Henry, at least it makes a bit of sense because he's like a weightlifter.
Oh, yeah.
Why is there powder in a casket?
Maybe the mortician needs to do a touch-up at the end.
Casket powder?
Casket powder, of course. Michaels hit a fucking moonsault off the top. Crowd was not as hot for this match. They started hot. They would get hot at the end. The casket would get hot at the end. But in the middle, the body of the match, I mean, the crowd was just kind of like, the rumble's over. Let's get this going.
The body in the casket would get hot, too.
There was a reverse Irish whip, and Taker got sent into the steps. And then Michaels lifted the steps, attacked Taker on his back, and then hit a pile driver onto the steps. Hunter then attacks Undertaker with his crutch. Michaels uses a chair. And they actually censored Michaels here, who told a fan in the front row to suck it.
How did they censor?
They just, like...
Oh, beeped it?
No, they didn't bleep it. They just cut the audio where he yells, suck it. Ross then notes that Shawn Michaels has beaten the likes of Diesel and Sid, but The Undertaker is in a different league. Taker then suplexes himself out of a sleeper. Michaels hits a kip up and then sets up for the sweet chin music. He hits it, places Taker in the casket, but then rather than shut the casket door, Michaels stands on top and Taker grabs him by the balls and throws him into the ring, where I'm sure a young Joey Ryan of California was watching this and his career started to blossom in his head about how he could incorporate his penis into professional wrestling. Taker then missed Michaels, rolled into the casket. Michaels hit an elbow drop into the casket, and it closes with both men inside. Michaels attempts to crawl out, gets pulled back in. Taker hits this big choke slam in the ring after they escape, and then hits this jumping tombstone
off the apron and into the casket, which cued the New Age Outlaws and the ultra-busy Los Boricuas on this show to run in and attack The Undertaker. The lights go out, and Kane's music plays, and people are thinking Kane's coming to help his brother. And he comes in, he attacks the Outlaws, he attacks the Boricuas, he clears the ring, but then Kane attacks The Undertaker. Choke slams him into the casket, and it is shut. And Shawn Michaels wins the match in 22 minutes and 23 seconds. Before we discuss the post-match angle, what did you think of the match?
You know, I'm not usually a fan of casket matches, but I thought Shawn and Taker did a good job here, especially considering the added historical significance of Shawn's back injury. It made this match quite entertaining, you know, to see this guy wrestle this whole match doing what he does with a broken back. And Shawn, you know, you could tell they had all these spots laid out, and Shawn was willing to go through all of them, even with that injury.
Yeah, and with Shawn Michaels, I mean, there was certainly, I mean, everyone looked back a year before this. Everyone knew Michaels was losing this title to Austin. So when this injury pops up, everyone has flashbacks to the year before and losing his smile and the knee injury that got him out of losing to Brett. This guy was legitimately hurt, and to his credit, he allegedly had a lot of headaches that he caused going into WrestleMania. At the end of the day, he worked the match, he lost to the guy, and probably had no business being in the ring at WrestleMania, given the state of his back. Mm-hmm. But this, yeah, this would be his last match before the WrestleMania match. And then after that, he had one match for his TWA promotion in 2000. But outside of that match, wouldn't wrestle again until the SummerSlam match with Hunter. So mm-hmm. would miss 4 years. And that TWA match, by the way, was with Venom, who was played by Paul Diamond, who was the actual guy who played Max Moon last week, and not Conan.
Yes.
As I
fact check.
Yes, was told many times by people.
Right. Yep. Me too.
Each time I was aware.
Yes.
So thank you. So that was the Royal Rumble 1998. And of course, the post-match angle.
Yeah, the post-match.
We can't forget this.
The most important part.
Paul Bearer and Kane padlock the casket shut. They wheel it up to the entrance, and then they get an axe, and Kane gets on top and smashes the top of the casket with the axe, and Jim Ross asks the question that is on everyone's mind. What is that? Is that gasoline? I don't know what that is. And Kane pours gas all over the casket and lights it on fire. And Jim Ross, with one of his Hall of Fame calls, "The casket's on fire! The casket's on fire!" As the show ends, and you are told to go resume your Sunday evening after seeing a major character murdered in front of 15,000 people in San Jose, California. I wonder if the authorities were called by anybody watching this.
No, probably not.
Well, they did open the casket up later for the live crowd to display nobody inside.
Oh.
Yeah.
Whoa,
which begs the question, what was the fucking point? But anyway, The Undertaker would disappear. And then he would reappear, this man just escaping death at the last moment, and would set up their WrestleMania showdown.
Mm-hmm.
But this Royal Rumble, it was designed to set up, it set up Undertaker and Kane for Mania, and it set up Austin going for the title against Michaels. Your two major matches for WrestleMania, and you clearly knew Mike Tyson was in the mix for the road to WrestleMania. Mm-hmm. So I think on an angle level, on a story level, this Royal Rumble accomplished a lot. As a singular show to view on its own, not a great show.
No. In particular, the Rumble match on this show I thought was very disappointing. Not all that creative or entertaining. But, you know, this show really did exist in the middle of you know, perhaps two of the most popular, more important pay-per-views, you know, in the company's history, in Survivor Series 97 and WrestleMania 14. So to see kind of that point of transition between those two into the Steve Austin era, I think definitely makes this worthwhile viewing, if only for the last moment of that Rumble and Shawn's match here at the end.
So that wraps up the Royal Rumble from 1998. I give the show a 4 out of 10.
Wow,
pretty low.
I thought this kind of dragged the show at points.
It wasn't the best show.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. 4 out of 10.
I give it a 5.5.
5.5?
Oh, my God, yeah.
Because of the minis?
No, I thought the main event was good. I thought it was a good match despite, definitely not being either man's, best match, but because of the historical significance, it was entertaining. And
It's rather amazing that this match occurred, Sean returned 4 years later, and yet it wasn't until 2009 these two would have a singles match together with the WrestleMania match in 2009 and then the rematch in 2010. Like, they did an incredible job of keeping these two separate. And I'm sure that was not by design. It was just circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But that was rather amazing.
There are also, at the time, they were probably both the most tenured guys on the roster. And maybe they kind of both served similar roles so that you didn't really need both of them paired together ever.
Yeah, and they would remember the 2007 Royal Rumble when it came down to those two. That was incredible. Mm. That final couple of minutes involving those two at the end of that year's Rumble, outstanding stuff. Okay, we're now going to go to your feedback up at lawradio.proboards.com. I'm going to remind people now, and we'll do it again at the end of the show, but our Royal Rumble pool is open for a few more days before this Sunday show. RoyalRumble.info. It's free to join. You can insert all of your picks in many different categories, and we'll be announcing the winner on next week's Review of Raw. And hopefully we'll have a prize to announce as well next Monday.
We can find out the winner that quick. Or Chris can.
Well, I said it on Monday, didn't I? Yeah, I think we'll know by Monday night.
Yeah, okay.
Chris is really on top of stuff.
Yeah.
I think we've long since passed the days of where, like, the first year we did that pool, and I had to, like,
count by hand?
By hand, by point. And it literally took me hours to tabulate. I think Chris is much more in the Excel age than I was. Okay, feedback. Matt in suburban Detroit. The 98 Rumble doesn't hold up all that well. In hindsight, the pay-per-view belongs in the bottom five of Rumbles. The minis and the Rumble were the only good things on this show. The Rumble had an interesting couple of stories, Mick Foley's three faces, the Nation lasting as a group almost to the end, and the Stone Cold versus Everybody story, which never paid off as everyone ignored Austin after he entered. Two karma-hitting HBKs back on the edge of the casket out of 10. Wow, from the heartless Matt in suburban Detroit.
All right, we go to Terry from Mid Wales, UK. Wow, guys, what a coincidence. I start watching Attitude Era Raws on the network, also rewatching this personal favorite Rumble of mine, and you guys picked this for the review. Perfect for a longtime listener, first-time contributor. He says, the pay-per-view was saved by its top two matches. The Rumble itself is by no means a classic, but as Austin's first babyface Rumble win, it launched him to the cusp of being the man to really kick off the Attitude Era. The casket match is probably the best one ever because it's Shawn and Taker, and their psychology was awesome. I find it odd that the bump on the casket that curtails Michael's career lacks any real impact. No showing of pain, no screams from Shawn, just odd. That match ending with Kane setting the casket on fire is still a sight to behold at the time I watched the tape, and even is today. I think I'll share a quick humorous personal story with my experience with this event. Years ago, I bought this tape after I got into wrestling. After this event, and for years it bugged me who the hell Tom Brandy was meant to be feuding with. JR never mentioned it on commentary. It's always just bugged me now and again. And with the internet not really turning out any answers, with the big reveal finally coming to me as I watch this old Attitude Era Raw, talk about a massive anticlimax with it being Mark Mero. A couple of questions. I was a big Ken Shamrock fan and never really understood why he left and was let go by WWF towards the end.
It was his choice to leave. It was in the fall of 1999. He wanted to, he was getting older, and he thought it sounds ridiculous today when he's still fighting in 2016, but in 1999, he thought, if I've got X amount of years left, I want to go back to fighting. He got a great deal from Pride, and he would go fight for them in 2000, and that was his choice to leave the WWF, and That was where he went. And you can't really fault him because he had some big years afterwards with the Tito Ortiz fights in 2002 and 2006. And here he is today in 2016, still making a good amount of money and someone that people still want to see fight all these years later, which is rather insane.
Aside from TNA, has the WWE ever tried to reach out to him? Is there any interest? I mean, I don't imagine at this point.
But Ken's pushed for it, but I don't think the WWE has ever really had that interest in bringing him back.
Even with like the spike in MMA's popularity?
I mean, if they wanted to, they had plenty of chances over the last decade, I would say, that Ken has been out there. And Ken's been open to it. Ken, whether it be the Hall of Fame or something, I mean, if you have a business proposition for Ken Shamrock, he's going to listen to you, for sure.
Strange.
All right, let's go on over here to Mick Whalen. Rumble 98 was the gateway for the Attitude Era. It was fun seeing Cold Stone Steve Austin winning the Rumble, even though everyone and their mother knew he was going to win. There has never been a bad Taker Michaels match, but even though this was a good casket match, it was arguably their worst match together. The Rumble was okay, but the outcome was never in doubt. Rumble 98 is a decent show for historical reasons, but little else. You two are always asked, what are your picks for best and worst Rumbles, but what would you say was the most average Rumble you ever saw? Everyone in between of the best and worst.
Yeah.
By definition, wouldn't it? I mean, this one to me would be below average if we're putting this on my scale.
Sure.
I mean, Battle Royals as a whole are usually not all that great.
Not for the in-ring quality, but I don't watch the Rumble necessarily for, you know, technical wrestling. It's more for storyline building and
it's like stories, that. It's creative spots and, that you can work in,
moments.
And keeping people's interest for a prolonged period of time, which there have been some great Rumbles, in-ring-wise and booking-wise. And then there's some others that have been very flat, and I would classify this as one of those.
We got a Rand from New Jersey. I've never seen a Rumble where there were so few believable winners. This Rumble had exactly one, Steve Austin. They were certainly not going to put Foley in the main event of Mania at that time. Rock and Triple H were also mid-carders. It would have helped Austin to enter the Rumble much earlier, maybe one or two, to give the match more of an unpredictable feel, but I assume they didn't want to have Austin wrestle that long so shortly after his severe neck injury at SummerSlam 97. The main event was another quality Shawn Taker match, but it was their third pay-per-view match in 5 months. They desperately needed to elevate guys like Austin, Foley, Rock, and Triple H.
Jamie from Baltimore. Sometimes the obvious booking move is simply the best. Austin was the hottest act in wrestling in January of 98 after completing a recovery from his neck injury the previous August. Without him, the WWF would have been in deep trouble. Everyone knew Austin was going to be the last one standing at the time, but it didn't hinder the crowd at all when Cold Stone was victorious in the Rumble. Rock and Austin always had great chemistry as Maivia was a solid choice to be the last one eliminated. Speaking of The Rock, I loved his old school heel tactics against Shamrock. The finish has Pat Patterson's fingerprints all over it. Much respect for Luna nearly getting killed during the finish of Goldust Invader. And speaking of, it's noteworthy how many mid-90s WCW guys were all over this card. Vader, Dustin Rhodes, Austin, Marrow, the Godwins, Ron Simmons, Cactus, and Hawk all come to mind. Gives this one 7 out of 10.
We got a Joe from Oakland. Well, a lot of people with a lot of thoughts, so I'll just skip. He's got a huge story here about his initial viewing of this.
Yeah, Joe attended this show. So he has a whole story about how he got these tickets and went to the show. So we're not going to read all of this. This is a miniature book.
I'll read some of it. He says, I remember clearly walking down the aisle 215 to see none other than Shane McMahon and Mike Tyson in the skybox. People frantically taking photos with their disposable cameras in this pre-selfie generation. It was a sight to see Tyson at such close range. Pat Patterson escorted me away from the scene with a nudge and said, All right, move this way, folks. At this point, it was showtime. WWF shirts being thrown out to the audience, announcers were out, air horns were blowing, and laser pointers were activated. Pyro goes off, little kids... Okay, thank you for setting the scene.
Play by play.
Oh, boy. Jesus. Okay, he says...
This is the prose of this.
It's really good. I just...
you know, I will... When I post the show... No. All this feedback will be attached to it in the same thread, so you can all read this detailed story. And we appreciate feedback like this, but this podcast will be an hour long. Let's go on over. Nick from Niagara. I won't take up too much time, so here are some random thoughts. I personally really enjoyed the opening match, but WWF really dropped the ball on Vader. He would go into a feud with Kane shortly after. The blow-off was a mask versus mask match. You practically see his face anyways. Luna took one hell of a Vader bomb. The Rock was a great heel.
They had a mask versus mask match with Vader.
That was the...
And Goldust?
Remember when he... No. With Kane.
Oh, Kane.
Remember afterwards, he called himself a fat piece of shit? That was Vader. Adding definition to his character. The Rumble wasn't outstanding by any means. It didn't seem like the roster had many stars outside of the final four. The depth of the roster is almost as thin as the WWE's this year. I haven't watched the casket match yet, but they always seem to end badly for The Undertaker. 6 El Torito imposters out of 10.
We got a DZ who says, I know it's being reviewed, so I don't need to recap, but just some things I noticed that are vastly different. But at the same time, with today's product, it's funny how a guy everyone knew was getting this monster push heading into WrestleMania, and yet no armchair bookers were crying about it being predictable or super strong Austin being pushed down our throats. And funny, no whining about an up-and-comer like the New Age Outlaws not being pushed harder, or how the prize fighter was putting over the guy whose face push failed. What exactly happened to fans? Did becoming wannabe bookers instead of fans become the norm?
Well, you're going back and you're watching a show from 1998 without any surround. I mean, there was plenty of people that were complaining how predictable it was about Steve Austin and where it was plain as day where the Undertaker Kane thing was going. But the point was, they still went with that direction. I feel that if you were to go back, if 18 years from now we pick out an episode of Raw from a week ago and watch Roman Reigns, I think people without living through the time period, they kind of just don't acknowledge that. I mean, there's people who will complain regardless of stuff, whether it's valid or it's being too judgmental, I feel. Let's do one more here. Chris from Penhold, Alberta. Watching this 18 years later really paints a picture at how shallow the roster was of big stars. Austin was on another level in comparison to literally anyone else in the Rumble, and in hindsight, was the only obvious choice to win it. This show could also be seen as Rock's coming out party with some foreshadowing of what was to come with Austin, Rock, and Foley making it into the final four. Did I miss their explanation of who number 22 was supposed to be? I assume it was Triple H, but even then, why no replacement? The main highlights of the Rumble for me were the three faces of Foley and Lawler acknowledging and laughing at Owen tripping when he ran to the back. The steel step pile driver Shawn delivered to Taker was brutal. All in all, not nearly as great of a show as my 12-year-old self thought it was at the time. 6 out of 10.
All right, we got a Chris in Ottawa who says, I always skipped the Goldust Vader match, but I definitely watched Sunny's entrance a lot. What a natural she was. WWE could use a lot more women with her confidence. Speaking of naturals with confidence, how about a 25-year-old Rock delivering a better promo than just about anyone in WWE today? But at least one thing the 2016 product has over 1998 is the 90-second interval in the Rumble match. 2 minutes was always too long, and I don't care if they take liberties with the clock or not. I agree.
Yeah, they sped them up significantly compared to the 93 show, and that was certainly the choice for the better. And let's do one more here. We'll do Andrew. This was a pay-per-view I would watch constantly. My aunt had an illegal box and would get me a number of WWF pay-per-views recorded on VHS tapes. The Rumble 98 was one of my favorites, and the whole show was really well booked and presented, except for one thing. I would watch the show all the way up to the Rumble, and after the match, I always skipped out on the main event. I honestly felt tired after the memorable Rumble match, and it felt to me that it's something that should have closed off the show. So that would be my only gripe with the show itself. One spot I liked, which would be great to use in the future, is the brass knuckles spot, where Rock stuffs his knucks into Shamrock's tights. I don't think it has been done since, and it would be a great way for a heel to squeak out a victory. The Rumble match was my favorite, the highlight, of course, being Mick Foley appearing 3 times. Great show, 9 out of 10. All right, well, thank you, folks, for your feedback. Now, next week, Wei, I haven't run this by you yet, so you have the option of shutting this down, but I thought with the expected arrivals of some certain talent that has been plying their trade in New Japan Pro Wrestling, that we could go back and review 3 episodes of the Access TV shows involving Nakamura, AJ Styles, Carl Anderson, and Doc Gallows.
Sure.
For a primer on these. Is 3 episodes okay?
Yeah.
Okay. These are all, well, under 1 hour in real time. We're going to review 3 straight weeks. These aired October 16th, 23rd, and 30th of last year, and they're all involving matches from Wrestle Kingdom 9 with the commentary of another person who has come into the WWE, Mauro Ranallo, mm-hmm. and Josh Barnett. So on episode 1, we've got AJ Styles against Tetsuya Naito. On show 2, it's Goto and Katsuyori Shibata against Gallows and Anderson. And then the October 30th episode features what was my match of the year for 2015, Shinsuke Nakamura and Kota Ibushi, which I'm very much looking forward to watching with the commentary of Mauro Ranallo and Josh Barnett.
When did these air on Access?
Last October.
Oh.
So a couple months back.
And can people find these anywhere?
Well,
if they looked hard enough.
We'll probably post them.
Oh. We will. Okay.
What are we going to do here? They're out there. They're on. Listen, give me a legal means. I can't get access in my home.
Uh-huh.
I can't. It's not an option.
Yeah.
I can't. So if it's there.
But if you do get access, please support.
Of course. This is a great show. This is arguably the best show, wrestling show on television at this point.
Mm.
There's some very good 1 hour wrestling shows out there, I've got to say. For all the flack that some people give about, you know, Raw's so long and stuff, Ring of Honor this past weekend was excellent with this Philadelphia street fight. NXT is a very well-booked show I enjoy most weeks.
I enjoy SmackDown now, because there's great commentary on it, but also because it's 2 hours.
I think that's a positive. New Japan is 1 hour every week. There's a lot of good stuff out there if you're seeking it out. So next week we will review those three episodes of New Japan Pro Wrestling on Access TV. Do you want to say what we're going to review in 2 weeks to give people a heads up?
Sure.
Okay. In 2 weeks, we've gotten a number of requests for this, and it's now available on iTunes and is selling very well. In 2 weeks, we're going to review the resurrection of Jake the Snake Roberts, and that will also coincide with Diamond Dallas Page, who is going to be joining us for The Law, the Sunday going into that. We'll have a portion on The Law, and then the interview will also be airing in full on Review Away to talk about the whole making of this documentary, his work with Jake Roberts and Scott Hall. So next week, the episodes of New Japan on Access, and then the following week, the resurrection of Jake the Snake Roberts. So you can go out. I recommend the documentary to go check out. So those are our next two reviews. And in the meantime, go up to royalrumble.info. You have a few more days to make the deadline for our annual Review Away Royal Rumble pool. It's free to join, and you have a chance to win. We'll announce the winner next Monday night on Review a Raw. And Wei Ting, are you going to be joining us Sunday night to at least watch the Royal Rumble?
Yeah, for sure. Of course. I got to take part in this pool.
Of course.
I got to make some money.
Yes, and if you are tuning in, we'll be on immediately after the Rumble at 11 p.m. Eastern time. And Braden Harrington will be reporting live from Orlando, where he is attending the Royal Rumble. And he's also going to the NXT tapings next week as well. So you will hear from Braden on The Law Sunday night. And we will chat with you later on this week. You can go up to liveaudiowrestling.com. Why don't you mention quickly the new t-shirt we have at prowrestlingtees.com/law.
prowrestlingtees.com/law, which it's come to my attention that a lot of you have been getting errors when accessing this page. And I've discovered that the reason for that is probably because some of you have been typing in law in capital letters. And the technology is such that it doesn't recognize. It's sensitive. It's sensitive to casing. So make sure you type in prowrestlingtees.com/law, all in lowercase, and you can access our store where you will find all our great shirts that we've put up there so far. But also our new Scott Putski Award winner shirt that we just recently put up there. Actually, it just says Putski Award winner. I don't know if Scott Putski would be upset if we actually put his real name. So some random Putski Award winner out there.
Gold or silver?
Yeah, I mean, they're just colors. They don't really indicate anything.
Of course
they do. I would have put a bronze up there for myself.
You could. The bronze would have been very funny, actually, for you.
Yeah, but Jason Agnew just texted me saying it's the most comfortable shirt he's ever worn.
Oh, my goodness. Well, there. A big win for you. How have the Christmas presents been for you? Have you been wearing the Jack Swagger shirt at all?
It's
I wore it last week.
Is this destined for the wall?
It's already up there.
No, already?
I'm not gonna. I'm not gonna wear it outside of this place.
Unbelievable.
And it looks good up in my wall.
Wow.
Where's my gift to you? Why aren't you wearing your Scott Putski Award shirt?
I have worn it over the last week.
Okay, where? In what setting?
At home.
Prove it.
What, you want me to take a photo of myself wearing it?
Yeah. Tweet it out.
At some point I will. You know, just remember, Way. Blank canvas up there.
Well, at least I hang my gifts up. I mean, they don't just sit in the closet.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Okay, well, that's going to wrap us up, folks. LiveAudioWrestling.com is where you can go for all of our regular shows, and we'll chat with you later on this week.
Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Cole is standing by with Iron Mike. JR, I'm here with Iron Mike Tyson. What did you think of the Royal Rumble match? What do you think of Stone Cold?
Intense, man. Cold Stone is my man. He won. You know, man, I won a fortune. I'm going to celebrate tonight. And no one believes that he can win. I'm just happy, man.
What about the upcoming championship match between The Undertaker and Shawn Michaels? Your pick.
That's going to be tough because I've been a great fan of The Undertaker for many years. Shawn Michaels, a young up-and-coming hungry tiger, and I'm looking forward to the match, man.
All right, that's Iron Mike Tyson back to ringside. Thank you.